WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music. For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sound of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT in sound from way out.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is fundamentally a conflict between two power blocks, Russia and NATO, which are armed with enormous numbers of nuclear weapons. And so we need to consider the possibility that this conflict could escalate to a nuclear war, as unimaginable as that is to all of us.
As tension rises over Ukraine, we'll look at what the media, the U.S., Russia, and NATO are not talking about publicly, the possibility of nuclear war. We'll speak about this nightmare scenario with Dr. Ira Helfand, who works with two Nobel Peace Prize-winning anti-nuclear groups. Then to Georgia. For the first time in Georgia's history, Ahmaud Arbery's murderers have been found guilty of federal hate crimes.
What the DOJ did today, they was made to do today.
Come on!
It wasn't because what they wanted to do.
That's fair.
They were made to do their job today.
Plus, pressure's growing on the Biden administration to fulfill a campaign promise to cancel student debt before the federal student loan payment moratorium ends in May. We'll speak to members of the debt collective.
A recent poll just reported that canceling all or a significant portion of student debt is supported by over 63% of likely voters. And yet, the president still has not delivered on his pledge to cancel student debt, despite the fact that this is a promise he can deliver on with the mere flick of a pen by signing an executive order.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and other nations have imposed new sanctions on Russia after President Vladimir Putin ordered troops into two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine, which the Kremlin recognizes as independent. President Biden warned Tuesday Putin is gearing up for a massive military attack on Ukraine.
This is the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, as he indicated and asked permission to be able to do from his Duma. Russia's moved supplies of blood and medical equipment into position on their border. You don't need blood unless you plan on starting a war.
U.S. sanctions will target Russian financial institutions, sovereign debt, and Russian elites. Biden said the U.S. has, quote, no intention of fighting Russia, but announced it's sending more troops and arms to Baltic countries, including F-35 fighter jets and Apache attack helicopters. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called off a planned Thursday meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, calling the latest escalation a rejection of diplomacy. Other nations, including the UK, Australia, Canada, and Japan, and the European Union also announced penalties against Russia. On Tuesday, Germany halted approval of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Ukraine has called a nationwide state of emergency and told Ukrainian citizens residing in Russia to leave immediately. President Volodymyr Zelensky said earlier this week Ukraine will not cede any territory to Russia and is calling on its allies to further ramp up pressure against Putin's government. We'll be looking at the issue of nuclear war with Ira Helfand of two Nobel Peace Prize-winning organizations. In Georgia, a jury found the three white men who chased down and murdered 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery guilty of committing federal hate crimes. Arbery was killed exactly 2 years ago today, February 23, 2020. Travis McMichael, his father Gregory McMichael, a former police officer, and their neighbor William Bryan were also found guilty of attempted kidnapping and other charges. They now face an additional life sentence. The three already received life sentences after their murder conviction in a state trial earlier this year. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper-Jones, welcomed the news but called out the Justice Department for initially offering her son's killers a plea deal.
What we got today, we would have gotten today, if it wasn't for the fight that the family put up on January the 31st. What the DOJ did today, they was made to do today.
Come on.
It wasn't because what they wanted to do. They were made to do their job today.
Ahmaud Arbery's father, Marcus Arbery, also spoke after Tuesday's verdict.
He loved his family. He called us every day. If he had but one word to tell you, guess what that was? I love you, Pop.
Yes.
I love you, Mama. He always told you that. Now these times you don't hear that, I'm struggling with that every day.
Ahmaud's mother called Tuesday Super Tuesday, the day of the verdict. In Kentucky, the trial for ex-cop Brett Hankison, who in March 2020 shot and killed Breonna Taylor, starts today. Hankison is charged with wanton endangerment for shooting into Taylor's neighbor's apartment during the tragic raid. He has not been charged with killing Breonna Taylor in her own home. A major new UN report warns of a global wildfire crisis as worsening heat and drought drastically increase the risk of devastating fires around the world. The study says the risk of fires could surge by over 50% by the end of the century due to the impacts of the climate catastrophe and that, quote, the heating of the planet is turning landscapes into tinderboxes. Scientists found even the Arctic and other regions that were previously not affected by wildfires face a high risk. It's the first time the UN Environment Program has assessed wildfire risks worldwide and comes as massive blazes across the western U.S., parts of South America, Australia, and other regions have intensified. Rights groups in Brazil say British, Canadian, U.S., Brazilian, and Peruvian mining companies are planning to expand operations in the Brazilian Amazon. A new report from Amazon Watch and the Association of Brazil's Indigenous Peoples says international investors have poured $54 billion into eight large mining companies and specifically calls out U.S.-based investors BlackRock, Vanguard, and Capital Group that have provided almost $15 billion in financing for mining companies with a history of indigenous rights violations and toxic pollution. The report also identified thousands of pending mining permits that would intensify deforestation on a combined area of indigenous lands as large as the size of England if approved by Brazil's mining agency. Hong Kong announced its 7.5 million residents will be required to take three COVID tests in March as it continues to be battered by its worst wave of the pandemic. Authorities announced this week business closures and other restrictions will be extended at least until April. Hospitals say Hong Kong's early policy to isolate or hospitalize anyone testing positive led to its healthcare system being overwhelmed.
None of the hospitals had any plans in place. The hospital authority had not provided any instructions for how to handle it if cases were to escalate.
In other parts of the world, governments are easing or removing COVID restrictions. In Britain, immunocompromised people and health experts have condemned Prime Minister Boris Johnson's announcement this week that the UK is ending all COVID restrictions.
So let us learn to live with this virus and continue protecting ourselves and others without restricting our freedoms.
Critics say the move will put medically vulnerable people at high risk and will imperil future responses to new variants. Palestinian officials said Israeli forces killed another teenage Palestinian boy in the occupied West Bank Tuesday. 14-year-old Mohammed Shahada was reportedly shot by the soldiers, who then prevented ambulances from reaching him to administer care. In other news from the region, an Israeli court has temporarily frozen the planned expulsion of a Palestinian family in the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The move came 1 week before the Salem family would have been expelled from their home amidst ongoing Palestinian resistance to the dispossession of their land and homes. Israeli forces continue to harass and attack protesters and residents in Sheikh Jarrah. In Burkina Faso, an estimated 60 people were killed and dozens injured Monday after an explosion near an informal gold mining site in the southwestern Pony province. Accidents are common at gold mines in the region, which operate with little oversight or regulation, often employ children, though the identities and ages of victims from Monday's disaster are not known. The United States women's soccer team and U.S. soccer have reached a landmark $24 million settlement, ending a years-long legal battle over equal wages. U.S. soccer pledged to give the women's national soccer team equal pay to the men's team in all games and tournaments, including the World Cup. The women's team filed a gender discrimination lawsuit against U.S. soccer in 2019, denouncing the drastic difference in wages compared to their male counterparts. They celebrated the agreement, saying, quote, "We look forward to continuing to work together to grow women's soccer and advance opportunities for young girls and women in the United States and across the globe." The U.S. women's soccer team has won 4 World Cup titles, while the men's team has won none. California is considering new legislation that would allow private citizens to enforce California's ban on assault weapons and ghost guns, home-assembled unregulated firearms. The measure is modeled after Texas's abortion ban. This is Governor Gavin Newsom.
If Texas can use a law to ban a woman's right to choose and to put her health at risk, we will use that same law to save lives and improve the health and safety of the people in the state of California. There is no principled way the U.S. Supreme Court cannot uphold this California law. None. Period, full stop. It is quite literally modeled after the law they just upheld in Texas.
Black farmers across the U.S. who were promised $4 billion in debt forgiveness as part of the pandemic stimulus package have been stuck in legal limbo thanks to lawsuits from white farmers. Some 15,000 farmers applied for the debt relief. The lawsuits claim the federal funds discriminate against white farmers, even though the measure was passed to help rectify generations of discrimination against farmers of color, including theft of land and refusal to grant loans. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law said, quote, "The USDA's racist policies of unfairly denying loans to black farmers has caused foreclosures and insurmountable debt from one generation to the next." The U.S. Supreme Court has denied Donald Trump's bid to block the release of White House records related to January 6 to the House committee investigating the Capitol insurrection. The decision puts an end to Trump's legal recourse in the matter. And Philadelphia housing justice advocate Jennifer Benich died last week of COVID-19 complications at the age of 36. Benich helped lead a months-long encampment protest in 2020 that forced Philadelphia city officials to hand over 50 vacant homes to a community land trust, a historic win for unhoused people. Benich was a member of Philadelphia Housing Action. We spoke to her in September 2020 about the significance of the victory.
Instead of allowing housing authorities to, like, sell units and make money off of them after they intentionally neglected them until they were too much for them to deal with, then allow community groups to take on those units and rehab them and use them for what their original use was, which is to house people in need.
Benich is survived by her 3 children. Her eldest has launched a fundraiser to support them in the wake of her passing. And a correction, in our previous headline on the trial for the ex-police officer Brent Hankison in Louisville, Kentucky, we said he shot and killed Breonna Taylor. In fact, no one has actually been charged for Taylor's actual killing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden has denounced what he called the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine after Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered troops into 2 separatist regions of eastern Ukraine while recognizing the areas as independent states. During a speech at the White House, Biden announced new sanctions against Russia and criticized Putin's actions.
He's setting up a rationale to take more territory by force, in my view. And if we listened to his speech last night, and many of you did, I know, he's setting up a rationale to go much further. This is the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, as he indicated and asked permission to be able to do from his Duma.
It remains unclear if Russian troops have actually entered the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, where 14,000 people have died over the past 8 years in fighting between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian forces. Putin has defended his decision to order troops into the separatist-controlled areas, claiming they were needed for, quote, peacekeeping. But UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres blasted Russia's rationale.
When troops of one country enter the territory of another country without its consent, they are not impartial peacekeepers. They are not peacekeepers at all.
On the diplomatic front, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has canceled talks scheduled for tomorrow with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Meanwhile, Ukraine has declared a state of emergency and urged all its citizens to leave Russia, where as many as 3 million Ukrainians live. This comes as the United States has announced plans to move 800 U.S. soldiers to the Baltics, along with 8 F-35 strike fighters and 20 Apache attack helicopters. Another 12 U.S. Apache attack helicopters are heading to Poland. As the prospect of a broader war increases, we turn now to look at an issue seldom discussed in the corporate media. Could the conflict over Ukraine lead to a nuclear war? We're joined now by Dr. Ira Helfand, the immediate past president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, recipient of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. He's also co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and serves on the International Steering Group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. His article, Ukraine and the Threat of Nuclear War, was recently published in The Nation. Dr. Helfand, welcome to Democracy Now! Just address this issue. Can you talk about what is at stake?
Good morning, Amy. And there's a whole lot at stake, unfortunately. We have found it almost impossible to imagine 30 years after the end of the Cold War that there could be a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. But the crisis in Ukraine is putting exactly that possibility on the table again. If the conflict there spreads, if NATO and Russia get drawn into active combat, both of these blocs have in their military doctrine provision for the use of nuclear weapons if things are not going well in a conventional war. And we have to understand that as long as nuclear weapons are on the table in this way, it is possible they will be used. The consequences would be absolutely catastrophic if even a single 100-kiloton bomb was detonated over the Kremlin. 250,000 people would die. It was detonated over Washington, over the Capitol, 100,000 people would die, 170,000 people. Hundreds of thousands of people would be injured, overwhelming the ability of local hospitals to take care of these patients. But if we escalate to the use of nuclear weapons, it is not likely that a single bomb would be used on a single city on each side. Rather, it's more likely that many cities in each country would be attacked with many nuclear weapons. And the studies that we have done back as far back as 2003 show that if just 300 of the 1,500 strategic weapons that the Russians deploy at this moment, if just 300 of these weapons detonated over cities in the United States, 75 to 100 million people would die in the first half hour. The entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. Everything that the population depends on to maintain itself, the internet, the electric grid, the public health system, the food distribution system, it would all be gone. The same thing would happen in Russia with a comparable U.S. attack on Russian cities. And these are just the direct effects, the immediate effects. A war between the United States and Russia would be a worldwide climate disaster. Hundreds of millions, perhaps as much as 150 million tons of soot would be put into the upper atmosphere, blocking out the sun, dropping temperatures across the planet an average of 18 degrees Fahrenheit. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, temperatures would drop 45 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. We haven't seen temperatures on this planet that cold since the last ice age. And under these conditions, the ecosystems which have evolved in the last 10,000 years would collapse, food production would stop, and the vast majority of the human race would starve to death. This is what we're facing, and this is the danger we're going to be facing as long as we allow nuclear weapons to exist.
And well, Dr. Helfand, isn't implicit in terms of what you are saying is one of the reasons why President Biden has repeatedly said that he has no intention of sending American military into Ukraine in case there is an invasion. What's your sense? Ukraine itself had nuclear weapons under the old Soviet Union. It gave up its nuclear weapons. What's your sense of the likelihood of this potentially occurring, that Russia will decide at one point or another, or the United States? If you could talk about where are the U.S. nuclear weapons, where are they stationed right now in terms of potential for use of them in case of a wide war?
Well, it's impossible to put a number, a percent number, on what the likelihood is that this is going to happen, and hopefully it won't happen. But Russia has today about 1,500 strategic warheads and about another 2,000 tactical warheads. The United States has about 1,500 strategic warheads and about 100 tactical warheads stationed in Europe. Britain has about 120 deployed nuclear warheads. France has about 280 deployed nuclear warheads. So there's a lot of potentially inflammable material sitting on the battlefield. We don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine. Part of the problem is just that when the conflict starts, there's, you know, people refer to commonly as the fog of war. Planning that was put in place before the conflict often becomes irrelevant. People lose contact with military units. Unexpected things happen. And we just don't know how a conflict would play out. I think, as you mentioned, President Biden has appropriately indicated that the U.S. would not plan to send military troops into Ukraine in response to a Russian invasion. But that does not mean that we are foolproofed against an escalation of this conflict, because there are so many things that can go wrong once a war starts, as we saw in Ukraine, as we saw in Iraq. The war plan that the U.S. Had sketched out before that conflict was not what happened. Totally unpredicted things from the U.S. point of view occurred. And the same thing can happen in a conflict in Ukraine.
Earlier this month, on February 8th, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned nuclear war would become more likely if Ukraine joined NATO. This is what he said.
I want to stress this one more time. I've been saying it, but I very much want you to finally hear me and deliver it to your audiences in print, TV, and online. Do you realize that if Ukraine joins NATO and decides to take Crimea back through military means, the European countries will automatically get drawn into a military conflict with Russia? Of course, NATO's united potential and that of Russia are incomparable. We understand that. But we also understand that Russia is one of the world's leading nuclear powers and is superior to many of those countries in terms of the number of modern nuclear force components. There will be no winners.
What about that statement by President Putin, in essence, alerting the other side, the United States and NATO, of the potential for a conflict like this to spiral out of control?
Well, the last point that he made, there will be no winners, is certainly the key here. But there has been no shortage of nuclear saber-rattling on the part of Russia or on the part of NATO and the United States. And that's been particularly troubling over the last few years. It's flown under the radar as far as much of the U.S. population has been aware of. But we have conducted exercises of nuclear-capable forces along the borders of Russia. Russia has conducted exercises of nuclear-capable forces along the borders of NATO. Both countries are spending enormous amounts of money enhancing their nuclear forces. And this is, frankly, an insane policy. You know, we have survived this far into the nuclear era only because we have been unaccountably lucky. Robert McNamara, I think, summed it up best. He said, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. It's not because we had wise leaders or sound policies or infallible technology. And the current policy of the United States, of Russia, of China, of each of the countries which possesses a nuclear arsenal is essentially a hope for continued good luck. And that's an insane basis for policy. We can't assume our luck is going to last forever. Sooner or later, if these weapons are allowed to exist, they're going to get used. And if they are used, the consequence is going to be absolutely catastrophic. I talked a few minutes ago about what would happen in a large-scale war between the United States and Russia. Even a much more limited war, as might take place between NATO and Russia, or might take place between India and Pakistan, we now understand would be a global disaster. As few as 250 relatively small nuclear weapons, less than 0.5% of the world's nuclear arsenals, can cause enough climate disruption to tank agricultural production across the planet and trigger a global famine that we have estimated could put up to 2 billion people at risk of starvation.
I wanted to ask you, apart from the nuclear weapons, do you have any concerns about nuclear power plants? Because Ukraine obviously has a significant portion of its energy is provided by nuclear plants. There's a Zaporizhia nuclear plant that had about 140 miles from the Donbas region, which has 5 reactors. Do you have any concerns about that in case of an armed conflict?
And Juan, let me dovetail off of that. You also have, of course, Chernobyl, which the meltdown that took place in 1986, which occurred in the Soviet Union, which is now Ukraine, close to the border with Belarus. As Juan, you said, Ukraine operates 4 nuclear power plants with a total of 15 nuclear reactors, one of them the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, located 120 miles from the Donbas region where the separatists and the Ukrainian forces have been fighting for years. Ukraine and the region could face another Chernobyl or worse. If one of these plants was bombed or went offline due to a power outage, a fire, or if workers fled due to a threat of violence, I want to turn to a recent presentation made by Linda Pence Gunter of the group Beyond Nuclear.
What if one or more of these reactors takes an accidental hit from a bomb or missile or even just artillery fire, then we could be talking about another Chernobyl, or actually multiple Chernobyls. A hit could destroy the reactor immediately. That's really the worst of all possible outcomes. But even if the reactor is severely damaged or disabled, then you start to lose coolant and the reactor heats up, the fuel rods are exposed, and explosive gases are created. One spark and you could see an explosion, as we did at 3 of the Fukushima reactors. Some of the workforce may be injured or killed or struggling to shut down the remaining reactors. And added to that, if the spent fuel pools boil and evaporate, exposing the rods, these could catch fire. And a fuel pool fire is even worse than the reactor exploding, because spent fuel pools contain a far hotter radioactive inventory than the reactor itself. Those radioactive releases would be dispersed across thousands of miles. We've already had a glimpse of what that would look like for human health after Chernobyl. But this time it would be worse. Ukraine's 15 reactors are all much older than Chernobyl Unit 4 was in 1986. They have bigger radioactive inventories, and they are all multiple reactor sites. People all across Europe would be affected.
So that's Linda Pence Gunter of the group Beyond Nuclear speaking over the weekend on a webinar organized by International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Dr. Helfand's group. Dr. Helfand, you also took part in that webinar. Can you talk about these concerns of a war occurring in Ukraine, a nation that relies so heavily on nuclear power?
Well, I think Linda summed it up extremely eloquently. There is a grave danger that these reactors could experience meltdowns. And this is also something that potentially could happen in Russia, where there are also large numbers of nuclear reactors. It does not require a direct hit in combat. A loss of electricity would result in a cooling failure and a meltdown, as happened at Fukushima. And, you know, there are 93 nuclear reactors, I believe it is, in the United States today, many across the rest of Europe. And each of these reactors is essentially a prepositioned weapon of mass destruction that we create and build and make available to potential enemies to detonate on our own territory. Ukraine is in a very difficult situation because of its reliance on these reactors for 50% of its electricity. These reactors are extremely vulnerable if the conflict that is now unfolding spreads, and there could be meltdowns at any one of them with severe radiological consequences. Enormous areas contaminated by radioactive material, many, many people exposed, many deaths, many cancers. It is one of the things that we need to be worried about in this situation.
Ira, who's paying attention to this in the Biden administration?
I'm not sure. And I don't mean to be particularly critical of the Biden administration. I think this is a problem with all governments that have nuclear weapons. They make their plans as if either the weapons won't be used, or if they are used, somehow or other, it'll all turn out okay. And we have always been shocked by the degree of ignorance on the part of world leaders about the potential damage that would be caused by their own nuclear arsenals. It's part of the job, I think, of citizens in general, of the physicians movement in particular, to educate leaders and the general public about this danger. No rational person who understood what nuclear weapons could do if they are used would countenance the continued existence of these nuclear arsenals. And that's why we've seen so many of the people who were architects of the nuclear arsenals, the whole nuclear strategy, later in life turn into impassioned critics of this whole way of dealing with security. Internationally, we've seen the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, adopted now by 59 countries that ratified the treaty, calling on all governments that have these weapons to abandon them and to negotiate the details they need to for a verifiable, enforceable, time-bound arrangement to dismantle the remaining warheads. Here in the United States, the Back from the Brink campaign has been launched to try to bring about the fundamental change in U.S. nuclear policy that is necessary to get us to a more safe place. We have assumed as a nation, and the other nuclear powers have assumed as nations, that nuclear weapons make them safe. What we need to understand is that nuclear weapons are the greatest threat to our security. And our security as a human community demands that we eliminate these weapons as soon as possible. Our luck is not going to last forever. Sooner or later, these weapons are going to be used if we don't get rid of them. And we have to understand that, and we have to take action based on that understanding.
Dr. Ira Helfand, I want to thank you for being with us, immediate past president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, also co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and serves on the International Steering Group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. We'll link to your article in The Nation, Ukraine and the Threat of Nuclear War. Next up, we go to Georgia, where for the first time in Georgia's history, Ahmaud Arbery's murderers have been found guilty of federal hate crimes. Stay with us.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver song of love. Walk
You'll Never Walk Alone by Brittany Howard. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It was 2 years ago today, before his name was known to the world, when Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was chased down, shot, and killed by three white men as he went for an afternoon jog in Georgia. Gregory McMichael, a former police officer, and his son Travis McMichael claim they were attempting a citizen's arrest of Arbery when they pursued him in their pickup truck. Their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit in his own truck and recorded a cell phone video that would later be released as evidence and spark a nationwide outcry. On Tuesday, after just a few hours of deliberation, a jury of 8 white people, 3 black people, and 1 Latinx person found them guilty of committing federal hate crimes. This is the first federal hate crime conviction in Georgia's history and comes after the men were already convicted on state murder charges. As each juror confirmed their vote to convict, the jury foreman, a black man from Dublin, Georgia, reportedly choked up as he answered through tears through his mask, "Yes." Attorney Benjamin Crump, who represents Ahmaud Arbery's family, spoke alongside the family after the verdict was read.
"And this is the first time in the state of Georgia's history where there has been a conviction for a federal hate crime.
Yes,
and you all did that.
Yes, sir. Hey,
yes, sir. You all did that.
Yes, sir.
Because of Marcus.
Outside the courthouse, Ahmaud Arbery's parents, Father Marcus Arbery Sr. and his mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, welcomed the historic verdict, calling it Super Tuesday. But they remain critical of the Department of Justice's initial offer of a plea deal in the case that would have allowed Arbery's killers to serve the first 30 years of their sentence in federal prison rather than state prison, which many consider to have harsher conditions.
I want to first say thank you to everyone who stood by us for this fight for justice for Ahmaud. It's been a very long, stressful fight for the members of the community, for the city of Brunswick, the state of Georgia, for the people who stood with us through the nation of the United States of America. Healing. I, as a mom, we will never heal. I now want to address the members of the DOJ. I'm very thankful that you guys brought these charges of hate crime. But back on January the 31st, you guys accepted a plea deal with these 3 murderers who took my son's life. That's not justice for Ahmaud.
Come on.
What we got today, we would have gotten today if it wasn't for the fight that the family put up on January the 31st. What the DOJ did today, they was made to do today.
Come on.
It wasn't because what they wanted to do. They were made to do their job today.
He loved his family. He called us every day. If he had but one word to tell you, guess what that was? I love you, Pop.
Yes.
I love you, Mama. He always told you that. Now these times you don't hear that, I'm struggling with that every day.
At a news conference in Washington, D.C. Tuesday, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland got emotional when he was asked about Arbery's mother's comments on the DOJ's proposed plea deal.
I cannot imagine the pain that a mother feels to have her son run down and then gunned down while taking a jog on a public street. My heart goes out to her and to the family. And that's really all I can say about this.
For more, we go to Georgia, where state lawmakers passed a resolution declaring today, February 23rd, to be Ahmaud Arbery Day. There's a march and a run and a walk through Satilla Shores, the neighborhood where Ahmaud was killed. We're joined in Atlanta by Anoa Changa, editor at News One and a retired federal government attorney. She also hosts the podcast The Way with Anoa. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. The significance of this first-time verdict, Anoa, the first time in Georgia, also very rarely in the entire country, that men were found guilty of federal hate crimes. Can you comment?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I mean, this has been a really remarkable case to watch unfold. We, like we heard in the comments, the family of Ahmaud Arbery, along with the surrounding community, really pushed for this case to even get out the gate in terms of the state case, and then, you know, pushing for the DOJ's involvement as well. So absolutely kudos to the family. And just really, I think this case highlights how far we still have to go in terms of the legal or so-called justice system in this country. It's really interesting that we are in this moment with the first ever federal hate crime charges or conviction in the state of Georgia, at the same time where we have elected officials who a year ago acknowledged the racist history in laws like the prior version of the Citizens Arrest Law, now denying the presence of race or even the necessity to discuss and engage in discourse around race in decision-making, in lawmaking, and in our judicial system. So just really thinking about the purpose of hate crime charges and really sending the message that this was an act that was based in racism, that was based in white supremacy and bigotry, does have a really interesting effect in 2022, that this is the first time this is happening, but it isn't the end-all be-all that I think a lot of people think it is.
And I know I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the key evidence that you believe that the prosecution presented to the jury to indicate that this was not simply murder, as they were convicted in state court, but that it was racially motivated.
Yeah, I think that this case lined up, I won't say well, it's hard to say that a case lined up well when we're talking about the murder of a young person in the prime of their life, but there were text messages, there were conversations that were had with the McMichaels, with people who, you know, being just what they thought was just, I'm just talking to my friend being racist, but that really helped make the case to show that the assumption that this Black man, this young Black man who was running in a neighborhood was really just, you know, someone who was criminal or someone who didn't belong there. And I think part of the problem is that even if Ahmaud Arbery, quote unquote, didn't belong in that neighborhood, even if that narrative was true, that's not justification for what the McMichaels, for what was ultimately done to him, you know? And so the being able to build that case and show how irrational the assumptions were, and so they were solely based on race. Like some of the different comments and text messages that were highlighted at the federal trial, which were overlooked or glossed over in the state trial because that was the strategy that the state prosecutors went for. But in terms of a federal hate crime, I mean, that is the ability. The charge is based on, you know, race or gender or sexual orientation, those things. So you have to be able to prove not just that they happened in this specific act, but also that there was a propensity. Another thing was the way the defendants lied about catching him in the course of committing crimes, because that's a part of that citizen's arrest justification, right? They were allowed to justify this initially under the guise that they had caught him in the act and were in the process of trying to detain him for law enforcement, and then things went awry. That was the original story, so to speak, right? And so they were able to pull back the federal prosecutors were able to pull back the layers and really show the through line of how these text messages or these conversations or even reportedly derogatory terms used in the course of the event and immediately afterwards played into the fact that this was solely because Ahmaud was a Black man and not because of anything else happening.
And I'm wondering if you could talk about the importance of Arbery's family speaking out against the original plea deal and the judge siding with them in terms of the impact of that, and clearly right in insisting that this go to trial.
I think the DOJ has a different ultimate goal. Like, generally, you know, when people say, oh, we're on the same side, we want the same things, I think that's generally true. But the DOJ has its mandate and is working across multiple cases and multiple jurisdictions to address the rise in hate crimes that have, that we've seen over the past couple of years. And they have their clearance rates and their other bottom line that they follow. I think the family, just listening to his mom in an earlier clip, you know, what is justice? What does that actually look like? You know, we've heard the same thing from similar families who never even got to a trial. When you think about Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin or so many others over the past several years, they never even got this far, right? But it's not that the family should be just satisfied that charges were brought and that there was a conviction. I mean, they were right to object because there is a role of the victims in terms of like weighing in on sentencing. And the federal judge to come back and say no, because I don't want to be locked into this deal. Like, it takes authority out of my hands in terms of sentencing. That was also, I think, really powerful in all of this conversation, because a federal judge could go along with the plea deal and been locked in, and then it would have shut the family out. And so that gave the family, you know, an advocacy lane, and it made the trial move forward. I think there's also an issue, even though it's the Department of Justice and it does have its certain mandates, there are limitations to the type of justice that can be administered through that department. Ultimately, what we saw here is a function of that. And just listening to Attorney General Garland and the emotionalness, like the empathy, that's great. And it's, you know, a change from past people in that position. But at the same time, there are so many cases that unfortunately get sent back to families like, we can't do anything. It was important that this case did move forward, but there's so many more cases out there.
And finally, we just have 15 seconds, Anoa, but what is being planned for today on the second anniversary of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery?
Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, there are community activities. There is a run walk going through the neighborhood later today. There's also a march by a coalition of folks later on after that as well. I mean, I think also people are moving forward and making sure that the state actually continues on a positive trend in addressing racial disparities in criminal justice and in the prosecutorial system. Prosecutorial misconduct and prosecutorial accountability continue to be something that organizers around the state are working on, which this case really highlighted at the state level how important that is.
And of course, at the federal level, the U.S. chose not to prosecute 82% of hate crime suspects from 2005 to 2019. Anoa Chonga, we want to thank you for being with us, editor at News One in Atlanta, Georgia. Coming up, pressure is growing on the Biden administration to fulfill a campaign promise: cancel student debt. Stay with us.
Tangle. It's time to make a change. I'm gonna move away and change my name. I said the world's in a tangle. What's going on? I'm going to a foreign land. Make it my home. You can be having a good day, as jolly as you can be. Bet you'll get the blues when you turn on the TV, 'cause the world's in a tangle. Oh, what's going on? I'm going to a foreign land and make it my home. Let me hear that mandolin a while.
The World is in a Tangle by John Tobias Willis. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden's facing mounting pressure to fulfill a campaign promise and cancel student debt for 45 million people. A moratorium on federal student loan payments that's been in place since the pandemic started is scheduled to end May 1st. In total, borrowers owe nearly $1.8 trillion in student debt. The Debt Collective is planning an action April 4th at the Department of Education. The group's message: pick up the pen and Joe. In January, dozens of Democratic lawmakers sent a letter to the Biden administration urging the White House to release a memo that the Education Department put together looking at President Biden's legal authority to cancel student loan debt. We're joined now by two members of the Debt Collective, a group with its roots in the Occupy Wall Street movement. Braxton Brewington is the press secretary of the Debt Collective. And Astra Taylor is the author of the foreword to the collective's book, Can't Pay, Won't Pay, The Case for Economic Disobedience and Debt Abolition. Her latest book, Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, Rebellions. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Astra, let's begin with you. Talk about what you're demanding right now.
We are demanding that President Joe Biden pick up the pen and cancel student debt. This is a pledge he made on the campaign trail, of course, because of grassroots pressure over the years, because debtors sounded the alarm about student debt, and because groups, especially the Debt Collective, actually laid out the policy mechanisms through which federal student debt can be canceled. And it turns out that this is one of the campaign promises that the president can deliver on his own without being stymied by Republicans or members of his own party. He has the authority to cancel student debt thanks to the Higher Education Act. Congress already granted the president and the education secretary the authority to cancel student debt. In fact, President Biden, during his career as a senator, voted to authorize the Higher Education Act to reauthorize it multiple times. So he, in fact, was part of the constituencies that granted the president, now him, the authority to do this. So the Debt Collective has already penned the executive order for him, and we're building political pressure to say you have to keep this promise because so much is on the line with so much of your agenda stalled and sabotaged by members of your own party.
And why is it that the president has not acted? Even he had a memo from his own administration, the Department of Education, telling him that he could move forward. Why hasn't he done so, in your view?
Well, this is really interesting. The Debt Collective had to submit a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, to prove that this memo existed. Because what the Biden administration was saying, what his press secretary kept saying is, well, we're waiting on this memo about our legal authority, which is ridiculous because the fact is this legal authority, it's called Compromise and Settlement. Again, it's part of the Higher Education Act, is the same authority they are using to cancel the interest as part of the COVID payment moratorium that they extended until May 1st. Again, they only extended that payment pause to May 1st because of grassroots pressure, because of people organizing and demanding that. So they're pretending they don't have an authority they're actually using. Why are they doing this? I mean, you know, one can only assume that it's because of a ideological, belief that we should treat something like education, instead of treating it as a public good, a democratic good, a right, is something that should be treated like a commodity. You know, the fact is Biden was part of the generation that built the student lending system. As we know, he was a major force in the 2005 bankruptcy reform bill that actually stripped protections from student borrowers. So, people are very, invested on multiple levels, ideologically and economically, in the system as it currently exists. And, but that's how so many things work. And so the answer to that is to keep organizing, to keep pressuring, to keep sounding the alarm about this crisis and, force them to do the right thing, which is to cancel not just $10,000 or $50,000 of student debt, but all of it.
And Braxton Brewington, I wanted to ask you about some of the players in this student loan industry. There's SoFi, for instance, which I think spent more than $600 million for the naming rights to the Los Angeles Stadium where the Super Bowl was held. And SoFi's CEO, Anthony Noto, told Yahoo Finance a few months ago about this moratorium. He says it was our largest business. It was our oldest business. That business has been running at about 50% of the pre-COVID volume for the last 20 months. In other words, SoFi has been losing money, according to their CEO, as a result of this moratorium. Your sense of how these companies, and there are many of them, like SoFi, what they're doing to the administration, the pressure they're mounting to get rid of the moratorium.
Well, that's exactly right. What we know is there's a huge profit motive behind the ideology of keeping 45 million student debtors indebted to either private loan companies like SoFi or even to the federal government. We know that student loan servicers like Navient have spent tens of millions of dollars just in the past year alone lobbying the Biden administration to turn student loan payments back on, even though they have countless documented accounts of taking advantage of individuals and being predatory in nature. So along with this gross profit incentive that is behind the incentive to keep individuals and debtors, there's also this economic incentive. Even within the Biden administration, you have the Domestic Policy Council, Susan Rice, Karma Martin, folks that are within the Biden administration who also have this economic ideology similar to what Astra just named, which is that debtors simply knew that payments were going to restart, right? They have this idea that maybe the pandemic isn't so bad and that individuals are able to restart payments. But we know that's just simply not true. 90% of individuals say that of student debtors say they're not going to be able to restart payments. And so the simple answer here is cancellation. But the motives are more than simply political, which largely people would say is a very obvious choice to cancel student debt for a president to do. But the motives go beyond political. They're also economic, and there's a very, very evil profit motive behind it.
Braxton, I wanted to ask you about a speech that Joe Biden gave on the economy when he was president-elect. It was in November of 2020. He said $10,000 in student loan debt should be canceled immediately.
The legislation passed by the Democratic House calls for immediate $10,000 forgiveness of student loans. It's holding people up. They're in real trouble. They're having to make choices between paying their student loan and paying their rent, those kinds of decisions. It should be done immediately.
So, Braxton Brewington, what's happening with that?
He's failed to keep that promise. Not only did he promise $10,000 immediately for every single borrower, he said if he went to a public college or any HBCU or minority-serving institution and make under $125,000 a year, that he'd wipe all of that student debt out as well. So now we are more than a year into the Biden administration where he said he would wipe out student debt unilaterally immediately. And that $10,000 was a minimum, actually. It wasn't a cap, it was a minimum. And not only has he failed to keep this promise, he has actually become more predatory on student loan borrowers, right? His DOJ is making it very difficult for people to file bankruptcy in the courts. Public service loan forgiveness, the waiver has failed hundreds of thousands of individuals who are currently being denied their rightfully owed cancellation. So not only has he failed to keep that promise, the Biden administration is actually being quite harsh on student debtors. And only because of the pressure that the debt collective and other allies have put on the Biden administration is it why we have a federal student loan moratorium now that's extending through May. And we're going to have to keep that pressure up to make sure that he fulfills that promise and goes beyond it to cancel student debt.
And Astra Taylor, I'd like to ask you, last week, Reuters reported that President Biden will ask Congress for a defense budget of more than $770 billion for the upcoming fiscal year. That's more than President Trump requested. How do you square this increased military spending while at the same time all of these millions of students and former students with crushing debt are still being unaddressed in long terms?
Yeah, those two things are deeply connected, because when it comes to fulfilling a promise like canceling student debt, the thing we hear is, well, how are we going to pay for it, right? The point is that we can't afford not to cancel student debt. Canceling student debt will boost the economy massively. It will help narrow the racial wealth gap. It will help people move on with their lives, buy homes, start families, all of this. But there's always money for the military. There's never, money for working people. What we need to do is stop funding war and fund college for all. Go back to the model where education is a right and public education is provided for free. So this resonates with our call for debtors to come to Washington, D.C. on April 4th. In advance of that May 1st deadline, we're having a massive debtors assembly and protest. It's important that people support that. If you have student debt or someone you love does, this is the time to act. We need to put the pressure on now. And April 4th is, of course, the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. And he called out the triple evils, right, of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. And, you know, it resonates with the call to cancel student debt. Student debt is a racial justice issue. It intensifies economic inequality, you know, and it is connected to militarism because, again, it's an indication that we don't spend on the public goods we need, like education. We spend on war. And also student debt helps the military recruit people, right? It's a major driver of enlisting it in the army. So we need to get to the root of the problem, but we will only do that by building power together. That's
Astor,
the debt collective slogan,
we have
right?
to leave We're it there. Alone. Astor Taylor, Braxton Brewington, members of the Debt Collective. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. And Grant, the emails and phone calls are still pouring in. Every once in a while, we have a conversation on this show that prompts so much response. And I tell you, it's like shoveling snow in a blizzard.
Oh, I think I know the call you're referring to. This is the middle emotion call, right?
Yeah, I never expected it to produce so much response. But this was the call from John in Bismarck, North Dakota. And he was looking for a term that specifies the emotion that's halfway between being deeply depressed and being euphoric. What is right there at that midpoint? And Grant, I don't know why, but people responded to that like you wouldn't believe.
So much thought and care was put into these responses. I know we both really appreciate that.
Indeed. And speaking of thought and care, here's a wonderful one from Amy in Libreville, Gabon. She writes, "My first thought was placid, like a smooth lake without ripples. If you look at the ebb and flow of emotions, you see waves, riding the high waves of elation and crouching under the crushing waves of depression." But then as Amy thought about it more in her email, she wasn't totally sold on the word placid herself. And then she said, maybe the right word is still. She said, if you look at a lake with no ripples, it is still. If you're without emotional ripple, you are still. Be still. And I just, reading that email and it just kind of caught me up short. Be still.
And such a basic, simple word that can mean so much. S-T-I-L-L, still, halfway between deep depression and complete euphoria. That might be the one. Although I might say that all the responses together combined, there might be an overlap between all these different words that are perfectly centered on the word still.
It could be.
I'm going to have to think about that response. That might be the perfect one. But if you've got a response that you want to contribute, by all means, send it along to words@waywardradio.org. And we like to talk about words and language, slang and dialect, things the kids and the grandparents say, something that happened when you were arguing about language at work, a funny sign that you saw, something goofy on the internet. Let us know on Twitter at WAYWORD or call us on the telephone 877-929-9673 and tell us what you're thinking. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi,
This is Lori. I'm calling from North Georgia.
Hi, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Lori.
Thank you. Hi.
What's up?
Now, this is a long-standing discussion. Is there a difference in the words unkempt and unkept?
Unkempt and unkept. All right. So you said this was a long-standing question. Are you arguing with someone about this?
Yeah. How long is
Well, not really arguing. Our whole family, we love words. We love books. And we're always, you know, noticing different words and things. And years ago, I said something about a person, and I said, they look very unkempt. And my husband said, that's not how you say it. It's unkept. I said, no, it's unkempt. And because I always thought that unkept was how you keep a room. It's how you describe a thing. And unkempt, with the M in it, is describing a person.
Uh-huh. And what does someone who's unkempt look like, Lori?
Oh, sort of like they've been, you know, sleeping in the bushes and their hair's a mess and maybe they didn't fix it this morning and they're just very, very disheveled.
Aha. Aha. And Lori, you are absolutely right. In fact, it's the word that I would use to describe someone who has a bad case at bedhead.